Moin! Welcome to On a Tangent, the podcast where the main characters are the voices behind the mathematics. My name is Simone, and in each episode I will interview a different early career mathematician from Münster to discover their paths towards mathematics and their hopes for the future. In this episode, I meet Rin, a postdoc from topology, and learn about how an inventor turns into a mathematician. I hope you enjoy the episode. So hi, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Hello.
So let's start from the past. Let's start from your earliest memory of maths. What is the earliest time maths has entered your life?
I think the first, I have kind of three candidates for this. The first one was that my mom had a lot of jewelry, and one of the things she found that kept me occupied was undoing the knots in the jewelry. So probably that's my earliest, just like undoing knots in like shoestrings and in jewelry and such. Also, my dad is a professional antique repairsman and has a full woodworking studio. And often people would come with just totally broken and splintered pieces of furniture that we would carefully glue back together. And I also remember that. But probably my first like math memory where I was like, ooh, there's something here. And I knew that that was called math. Was when I took calculus, I remember like learning about Riemann sums. This sounds really silly, but when I was learning about Riemann sums, I felt like this thing that I had done when I was younger and bored in class is that I would sometimes kind of draw lines in the air and then mentally like stack things from around the room under the lines. And I was like, oh my God,
they reinvented Riemann sums.
They packaged this thing that I do in my head in like one tiny package. And however else anyone else thinks about it, they can unpack it in that way. And I was like, that's really cool that you can really like package just a huge amount of like tools and information in this like really small symbolic framework. And that's like the earliest time I was like, ooh.
This is something I want to see more of in my life.
Yeah, exactly. I enjoyed this ability of talking about one thing many different ways in like a unifying language, I guess.
And do you feel like these three experiences you talked about somehow were already precognition of what later you would do in maths?
Not really. No. I mean, I do think that I'm a pretty visually thinking person, but I don't think they necessarily pointed to the area of maths that I ended up working in.
Which, now that this comes up, so what is it that you do in maths?
Yeah, so I work on kind of a combination of a lot of different fields, but mostly I do kind of arithmetic geometry, homotopy theory, representation theory, number theory, I guess.
And how do you explain this to people at parties? I mean, if they ask, which is, of course, we all understand.
Yeah,
consensually so, explaining maths to people.
Right, of course. So, I mean, I guess the first thing that I say, if someone asks me what I do, I say I like thinking about shapes and numbers. And if they ask more than that, then I say, well, I study the way that maps between higher dimensional spheres are related to counting points on curves.
So spheres we can imagine, curves we can more or less imagine.
Yeah, and counting, people know what that is.
Roughly, yes, right.
And that's like, yeah, you know, I struggle sometimes, but so do we all.
It's always a humbling experience, right, when you're the mathematician in the room and they expect you to sort of, can you please compute the bill at the restaurant and... Well, no, I can't. I mean, I could, right? I mean, with some time, but not this, definitely not what I consider within my skill set. I mean,
Yes, it's very different from, I think, the kind of everyday type of math that we do, for sure. Although, I have had a few of these moments over the years where sometimes I'll be doing math and I'm, like, doing math, you know, computing a 5x5 matrix or, like, counting, comparing a bunch of numbers to each other and trying to find a common factor. And I'm like, this is what people think mathematicians do. And right now, I'm actually doing this.
Exactly. And this is what mathematicians often struggle at doing, actually.
Yes.
rather than, I mean, somehow the higher dimensional spheres are fine. It's the arithmetics of integers which we sort of not necessarily grasp, right? I mean,
right. I mean, this is somehow more of a trained skill in like the ICM crowd, or sorry, ICM is the wrong word. What's the word for the competition math?
I mean, the IMO.
IMO, thank you.
So were you an IMO competitor?
I was not an IMO competitor, but I do think that IMO competitors tend to be better at these sorts of kind of quick calculational skills than the average mathematician is.
Yeah, that there's often, I think, the belief that if you're a good IMO competitor, then that necessarily means you're going to enjoy a lot of mathematical research, which I don't think is necessarily, there's necessarily a big correlation there. I
mean, no, it burns a lot of mathematicians out. But I do think that the IMO is pretty good at effectively teaching proof methods.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In fact, when I eventually kind of decided to professionally enter mathematics, the thing I struggled with is that I had never written a proof before, and I used a book for IMO students to learn how to do basics of proof writing.
So how did you get to maths? How did you get to what you do nowadays?
So I have like a somewhat convoluted path toward the way I got into math. So I was working in robotics and engineering. Well, actually, it kind of started even earlier. So when I was in uni, I really kind of didn't really quite know what I wanted to do. And then eventually, I took this calculus class. I got really excited about that. And I wanted to do pure math. And at the time, the person who was mentoring me was a burnt out postdoc. And he was like, Rin, you don't want to do mathematics. You could actually help people. And I was like, okay. So then I did like robotics and plasma physics for a while. And then I got a grant to be an inventor. And I was doing that for a while, and I was doing math as a hobby.
I need to backtrack on this a bit. Mm-hmm. An inventor, as in, because somehow, maybe to me, the image of an inventor is like like Archimedes in the Mickey Mouse. So somehow, somebody who is in the lab the whole day and actually builds things. Is that actually?
That was what I was doing. I mean, the grant that I got is called the Teal Fellowship, and it's given to 20 people under 20 years old who kind of have a project in mind that they want to do. And it's for $100,000. And it's given to the person, not the project. So, I mean, what my project was doing medical technology, improving wheelchairs in various ways, and neuroprosthetics and stuff like that, and improving preclinical trials. So being able to detect stuff that we weren't previously able to detect in preclinical trials until they reached human stage earlier using technology. And so I was doing that, and I was doing math as a hobby. And then I just, like, really reflected on what aspects of my job I liked and I didn't like. And I realized the part I liked the most was the math part.
Right, I see.
And I decided that I would, you know, try that. Wrap up the projects I had at the moment, give them to other people, and try just doing math for a month and see how I felt. And the month never ended. Yeah.
So how did you go from somehow medical technology to arithmetic geometry? I mean, that's quite a jump.
Yeah. So I guess the way that I kind of went through it was I was at this like party where the person who is behind the Teal Fellowship, Peter Teal, has meetings with the fellows. And we had this kind of questionnaire that was open, and kind of we could all ask him questions. And at the time, I had a friend who was a pure scientist who was struggling in various ways, and someone who was then a hedge fund manager but had been a theoretical physicist before, Eric Weinstein, he came up to me and he was like, oh, if you're a pure science Teal fellow, why haven't I met you before? And I was like, well, because I'm a mechanical engineering fellow. And he was like, well, tell me about like some of the things that you're interested in. And this was the day before I was going to start studying math for a month. And
a month.
Yeah. A month. 8 years.
And counting,
yeah. And I kind of asked him various things, and he was like, you know, have you heard of the Atiyah-Singer index theorem? And I was like, no, what a good place to start. Like, sure, let's look at it. And I was like, damn, this is really cool, you know? And that's kind of where, that was one of my entering points into maths. And the way that one of the ways that I still learn, and the way that I learned then, was I would print out a paper that I found interesting. I would outline all the words I didn't know, which were most of them. And then I would look up John Baez and that word, and I just read every post he wrote on the topic.
And on most words, you would find something.
Yes. And so I actually learned, I was able to learn enough from doing this, just locking myself in a room for like 3 months and doing this, enough to start attending classes at Berkeley, which was nearby because I was living in San Francisco at the time. And so I started sitting in the back of lectures. And at some point, I kind of reached a point in Eric Weinstein's mentorship where he realized I needed to, you know, actually be talking to a real mathematician. And Edward Frankel was also affiliated to the Thiele Fellowship, who's a professor at Berkeley. And he started meeting with me weekly. And at some point, I reached a point in his mentorship of me where he was like, the questions you're asking me are a little too topological for me to understand. You should kind of be asking. And he started to introduce me to people in the mathematical world. And also I met them through just showing up in classes and asking questions.
So that's how somehow, so by this sort of repeated process of reaching the limits of the expertise of somebody and going to the next one is how you eventually ended up in your field.
Yeah, and I think that's still how I do math. I mean, the last, something that I have really enjoyed about my Unimünster postdoc is that I think the way that I best learn is by doing this. And so I'm able to, if I want to learn a topic, fly to wherever that is, take a train to wherever that is, talk to that person for a week, a month, however long, then go to the next place, or write up what I learned and then go to the next place. Mm-hmm. And
somehow do you think there was any connection between your past as an inventor and your daily life as a mathematician somehow? Now, I don't want to get into the topic of is math created or discovered.
No, I don't care about that.
Also, it would take, like, you know, infinitely many hours.
Oh, sure. Maybe I should have said that instead.
Well, I mean, one of the two, right? And you only have so much energy you can invest in something, right?
Sure.
So let's not get into that. But somehow mm-hmm. this idea of letting ideas flow and coming up with something new, do you think somehow this was always in at least hidden away somewhere?
Yeah, so I think I've always known that I wanted to be a researcher of some kind, or maybe a creator, and preferably both. And so I think that has like continued to influence my development as a scientist and artist, as a person, like in all areas of my life.
So what would you like to see happen in the somehow remainder of this 1 month in maths that you've been doing for 8 years and a bit more? What is an answer to some question that you would like to see?
I've always been really fascinated about the interplay between kind of manifolds and topology and number theory and arithmetic geometry. And this has been evolving quickly and like beautifully in the past couple years. I mean, I feel like a paper comes out almost every month now that just like puts together another piece of this puzzle. And it's kind of a broad picture that I'm devoting myself to, but let me try to express it. So there's somehow a connection between L functions, topological genuses and like Euler characteristics, and boundary conditions on topological quantum field theories, or kind of Grundig-Riemann-Roch type statements, the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, etc. And I mean, it's really just amazing how these things are starting to feed into each other. I mean, for example, this kind of started with me looking and seeing that the Bernoulli numbers were showing up all over homotopy theory and in homotopy groups of spheres. And my goal is to kind of sit down and be like, okay, so we know the Bernoulli numbers show up, but what other arithmetic invariants show up? What other L functions? What other generalizations of the Bernoulli numbers show up? And as I sat down to do that, I realized that we, in fact, don't understand why the Bernoulli numbers show up.
They just happen to show up.
Yes, and right now it's just kind of a set of numerical coincidences, and together with my collaborators Noah Riggenbach and Andres Mejia, we put together this picture that kind of categorifies all of the different instances that the Bernoulli numbers show up in the homotopy groups of spheres, and seems to imply that they come from kind of this greater structure. And so that's nice, and in some sense, a key part of like the perspective that we developed is that the Bernoulli numbers are capturing the lattice of Z sitting inside of the real numbers. And you can ask, if you generalize to other lattices, you know, SL2Z or SP, like the symplectic group on Z, or any other group you'd like that's discrete, living inside of a topological space, you can also ask for a generalization of the zeta function there. You can ask, what sorts of Gauss-Binet theorems do you get? Do you get a generalization of this beautiful statement that haunts me to this day, that the zeta function of 1 minus 2g is equal to the Euler characteristic of the moduli stack of genus g curves with one marked point? So you have this like topological invariant of a moduli space being equal to the zeta function of the dimension of the moduli space. And you can ask, well, what if you put something other than the mapping class group there? What if you put the symplectic group? What if you put SLN? Do you get on the other side the generalization of the zeta function to that lattice? And this kind of fits into a different picture. So you do get that the orbifold Euler characteristic of like SLN, for example, or SPN to the symplectic group, is equal to a product of zeta functions. But there's no known connection between the mapping class group case, which gives you one zeta function, like a zeta function of 1 minus 2n, and the symplectic group case, which gives you a product of zeta function minus 1 all the way to zeta function of 1 minus 2n. And like there's a map from one of these groups to the other, and there should be a connection, but we don't know what it is. And a lot of this amazing recent work, so for example, this recent work of Amina and Akshay Venkatesh, where they were really able to use Rademeister torsion and the topology of knots to prove things about L functions of symplectic representations. And I feel like in recent years, we've really been able to have these two fields fully talk to each other. These analogies are becoming actual proof techniques. They're emerging into a, like a bridge in a language.
No more heuristics, but actual frameworks to understand things.
But for now, the frameworks are still, they still need more work. I mean, somehow they're hinting at this like very simple, beautiful global structure that specializes to these two worlds. It specializes to the topological case and specializes to the zeta function case. But right now, getting in between those two worlds is still unbelievably difficult. I mean, their paper is really, really hard work. And again, it comes down to a sort of numerical coincidence, which would be really interesting to try to categorify and see if we can specialize. And it's also kind of cool because you can see things like the Euler characteristic could be written as a type of duality statement, like the Euler characteristic of a manifold is equal to the Chern character of the manifold times the Chern character of the dual of the manifold evaluated on fundamental class. And in fact, in a lot of path integrals that show up in field theories, you get these bosonic fermionic cancellations that make your path integral converge. And it seems like there's a connection between some of the path integrals that show up in string theory, where you're not just mapping, say, S1 into your manifold, but you're mapping some other world sheet, you know, genus G curve into your manifold. It seems that those path integrals in the statements, for example, for genus 1 curves, you get that the Riemann zeta function of minus 1 shows up as a correcting factor, which is the Euler characteristic of the moduli of genus 1 curves with one marked point. And right now there's no framework that really explains why that's
showing
up.
Why these things happen, yeah.
And I think that, I'll just like reiterate this somehow, this triangle of like L functions and zeta functions, they're generalizations to other lattices, topological genuses, orbifold Euler characteristics, and these like Grotendieck-Riemann-Roch duality statements, which show up in boundary conditions of invertible topological quantum field theories. And invertible is important here because somehow the way that it's connected is showing up as something in its dualizing object. So a lot of the arguments that show up there end up being some sort of Fourier transform that picks up a term, a measure on a space that allows it to converge. And this renormalizing factor seems to be Euler characteristics, like elliptic genuses. So I'm really, really curious to see, first of all, if we can really make this picture that I've been developing work that really show that the Bernoulli number instances that we know specialize, that there's this categorification really does give you an explanation of where all the Bernoulli numbers show up in the homotopy groups of spheres, and also in general, this kind of a categorified framework which allows us to talk in the same breath about symplectic groups and the mapping class group and their measures and their Euler characteristics, just living in the same world. So
that's really fascinating. Thank you very much for this.